Coming up in today's Ideaspace podcast.
You know, when you're doing it for the first time, you kind of you feel a little bit like a fraud sometimes. You know, you're kind of making it up as you go along, and you're trying to convince people to give you millions of dollars. Every challenge you have, every setback, everything that goes wrong, every decision you make that turned out to be a wrong one that you've then got to reverse and make it better, actually increases your competitive differentiation over time. Focus on getting satisfaction from the journey, not the end goal.
Yeah.
The money is, money is not the most satisfying thing in the world anyway. Yeah, the satisfying thing is doing things that you feel are worthwhile with people that you enjoy spending time with.
We're excited to release this special episode as part of Cambridge Tech Week, celebrating the innovation and entrepreneurial spirit driving this city forward. Today's guest is a true deep tech pioneer. I'm thrilled to welcome Scott White, a seasoned founder and serial entrepreneur behind 9 technology ventures, including Pragmatic, QD5 Technology, and Quantware. Scott's career spans 25 years of building and selling companies across telecoms, photonics, and machine learning. He holds over 60 patents and was named Deep Tech Entrepreneur of the Year in 2022 and a Lifetime Fellow of the Bessemer Society in 2023. At Pragmatic, he led the development of a groundbreaking flexible semiconductor platform now being used to tackle major global challenges from sustainable growth to national security. He also advises Deep Tech Labs, mentors with Intel Ignite, and sits on the UK government's semiconductor advisory panel. In this episode, we'll unpack his journey, looking at the wins, the tough calls, and the lessons learned. Scott, welcome, and thank you so much for joining us on the Ideaspace podcast. It's really appreciated.
Great to talk to you, Ben.
So I wonder if you could just, take us right back to the beginning, really. What inspired you to take an entrepreneurial route? Was there any kind of defining moment that pushed you to start your first company?
Not really. It was more by happenstance than anything else. I studied originally as a scientist at mathematics and computer science, but then ended up working at McKinsey as a management consultant. So got great business experience there, but ultimately found that frustrating because you were working with some of the biggest companies in the world, but you realize how slowly they actually change things. And it doesn't matter how great a strategy you put together, what really matters is whether it gets implemented properly or not. And so I decided to leave there and joined a telecoms research center, which was looking to spin out some of the exciting technologies that are developed. And so I restructured the center so it could do that and took the first exciting technology through that process. And that became my first company. And so that was just, became the start of a journey that then I enjoyed that so much that I did it several more times.
Yeah, plenty of times. And when you first started out, were there any kind of unexpected skills or knowledge gaps that you had? And how did you kind of overcome that, if so?
Oh, more than I can count. So probably the most explicit I can remember was, I put together a business plan for this first company, which was very theoretical and academic, I would say, in hindsight. So it was a, 50-page document, and it had all the right sort of elements in it. But if I compare it to the kind of business plan I would develop now, which would be more like 20 to 30 PowerPoint slides that really distills the most important things rather than just focusing on kind of verbose explanations and lots of flowery words and things like that. So I think, the biggest gap was the difference between theory and practice and kind of what matters in the real world versus what, on paper seems like it should be important.
Yeah. And obviously people talk about it as a sort of founder's, like a roller coaster, the founder's journey. What's the kind of biggest or most significant personal transformation you might have gone through since your first business, if you look back all the way from, from now all the way back then?
I mean, again, it's been a long time, so it's sort of hard to pick one specific transformation. It is very much a continuing journey. I guess certainly something that's changed since my first startup back in the late 90s to more recently is a change in confidence level. When you're doing it for the first time, you kind of you feel a little bit like a fraud sometimes. You're kind of making it up as you go along, and you're trying to convince people to give you millions of dollars, and you know, you really don't quite know where it's going to go or what the challenges are going to be. And so I think having been through that journey a few times, I can now be more confident, not necessarily that it's all going to work out perfectly, because I don't think you could ever predict that, but just that the approach I'm taking, the way I'm thinking about the business, the way I'm thinking about how to address the challenges is a constructive and, you know, relevant approach to it. So I can, you know, I kind of feel like I can do as good a job as anybody given the unknowns in a particular environment.
Yeah.
So that's sort of been a continual change. But I think probably if I was to pick a sort of significant step change shift, it was really about halfway through the pragmatic journey when we, as a management team, took a step back and focused on why we were building the company and what we wanted to focus it on, rather than just the what we were doing and whether it would be successful. And that led to quite a different mindset shift in how we focused on certain things. So these days, I think a lot of companies start with that, with a sort of a mission or a passion basis for what they're doing. I guess prior to that point, my startups had been rational, logical decisions of, you know, this is a reasonable business to build because I think it can be successful and make money. And there was that shift to, well, that's obviously still important. You cannot build a business without those factors, but actually having personal passion and excitement around what your technology is going to do and how it's going to change the world, and is it going to make people's lives better? You know, that element, I guess I came late to that element, whereas I think perhaps in, you know, millennials, it's a little bit more embedded as sort of part of the starting point.
Right. And speaking of pragmatic, obviously that's been the core, I guess, or externally, it seems to be the case. So, can you just talk us about how that started? What was the initial sort of vision for the company, and how did you approach those challenges of starting what has become a really massive, successful company?
Yeah, so, it is interesting because obviously prior to Pragmatic, I built and sold 5 previous tech companies in telecoms, photonics, and AI. And so, I've sort of become known as having started and grown Pragmatic and, you know, the semiconductor industry being kind of where I'm most prominent, but actually, you know, semiconductors I knew virtually nothing about before starting Pragmatic.
Right.
And I think the reason Pragmatic has become so prominent is partially its success in the journey, but I think more than that, the way we've focused it around some big themes around that are relevant to government, that are relevant to society and geopolitics and things like that. In terms of how we started, it was, I guess, much like my previous business. It started from the seed of an idea. In this case, it actually evolved from a previous company I'd got involved with called Nano ePrint, which was been out from the University of Manchester. That was an interesting technology, but it became apparent a couple of years in that it wasn't really a complete package of technology. It wasn't sufficient to build a business around. And so after many discussions with the kind of original academics and shareholders, we decided not to continue with that. But it led to the idea that Richard Price and I started Pragmatic around, which was, okay, well, let's build from the ground up the technologies we think we need to do to address a big market opportunity we've seen. And so it started from a very pragmatic approach of, there was lots of excitement around printed and flexible and organic electronics, but what we saw at that time was a lot of technology push, you know, things that have been invented in an academic lab that were interesting and different, but actually didn't necessarily really fit exactly with what the market was asking for. And so we'd kind of flip that around and said, okay, this is what the market really wants. Let's go develop the technologies we need to actually make that happen. And that led to a new kind of semiconductor manufacturing platform.
Right. So, I mean, obviously, it sounds like the vision was probably a large one, but a lot of that's based on the fact that with your previous experience, you know what's possible and not possible, I guess, at that point.
Well, I think the vision also evolved and grew substantially as we built the company. So when we first started, the vision certainly wasn't anywhere near that broad. It was, you know, we had a few consumer goods companies who were interested in whether we could make the equivalent of silicon chip, but in plastic and for a fraction of the cost. And if we could do that, you could sell it in smart packaging for stuff that you'd buy on the supermarket shelves. And yeah, that was a big market opportunity, but in one sense, it's quite a narrow vision. It was very much a kind of product focused, you know, one big application category, you know, company. And we thought when we originally developed it that it might be a licensing business, you know, develop the technology to a certain point and then license it to an existing semiconductor manufacturer and, you know, an exit at that point. And what we realized 4 or 5 years into that journey, having developed proof of concept of the technology, was really two things. One was that the opportunity was much, much bigger than we had originally anticipated. So it went well beyond just sticking it on, you know, lots of things you might buy in the supermarket, but it had applications in security, it had applications in flexible wearable devices. You know, there's just, you know, I mean, ultimately we sort of managed to quantify this as well over $100 billion addressable market. So the opportunity was way bigger than we thought. But at the same time, the route to commercialize it was very different. It actually didn't make any sense to license it to an existing fab, because part of the benefit of our technology approach was you didn't need a bunch of equipment that you have in a conventional fab. So if you've already got that fab, not using half of the equipment you've got isn't actually a benefit. Whereas if you start building that fab from an empty building, then it's a huge advantage because you dramatically reduce the capital cost and the size of room you need and all those kinds of things. Mm. So what we, you know, what we kind of realized was the way we actually got best leverage of our technology was to take it into manufacturing ourselves. And that meant we had to shift strategy from what at that time was a kind of self-funded, angel-supported type of approach to, well, we're now at a point where this does need proper institutional venture funding. So let's, you know, let's flip to getting in the right strategic and venture investors to fund that journey.
I mean, that's obviously... That's a massive change, isn't it? From something that could have been built on a licensing model to into manufacturing. I mean, that's a huge shift. Were you all on board with that? So what? I'll go back. What's the size of the team at that point?
So at that point, we had probably about 20 people in the team, and yeah, I mean, it was myself and Richard Price, my co-founder and CTO, that really kind of worked through that. And We and our sort of early shareholders as well. It was an interesting discussion, I think, particularly for the early sort of angel investors supporting it, because for them it was a big shift from, well, this could be a relatively quick, modest return, to, you know, doubling down for a much longer journey that could be a way more exciting outcome, but was going to take a lot longer and involve, you know, us all giving up more control of the business because you need, you know, venture investors to have the right stake in the game and so forth.
Yeah.
It wasn't a no-brainer, but we had sort of some offers to acquire the business or to license the technology then, which ultimately we sort of walked away from to follow this strategy. And happily, it's, you know, in terms of the value we've created in the business, you know, it's several orders of magnitude more valuable than it would have been if we'd exited that point.
And that's quite a brave, I suppose with hindsight it's probably easier to look back, but it seems like a really quite a brave and bold decision. And I guess that again is because you'd have had that experience of multiple businesses before.
I think the previous experience certainly was helpful, and also just the financial flexibility. You know, yeah. I mean, it's very easy when you've had some prior successes to be a bit more accepting of risk and say, well, it's, you know, it's worth going for something bigger here because that'll be meaningful.
And were some of the early investors in the other company again on board with this one? So was there that relationship and that trust built up anyway, or was it a new set of investors that you had to?
It was actually quite a different set of investors. Okay. And that was for a variety of reasons, partially because of different sector of technology, different stage of business, different route that we'd gone through to get there. So, by the time we were at that point with Pragmatic, we had been essentially bootstrapping the business for 5 years. And so you know, what you find is the venture environment is quite a small one, but it's also one that changes quite rapidly. So if you haven't been raising a Series A for 5 years, most of your contacts are out of date.
Right. God. You don't think about that actually when you, if you haven't gone through that process or that had that experience, you wouldn't have thought that's the case. But yeah, you can see that would be so. In terms of the team, so you've got a small team, and then you're moving into something where you're having to do, this journey where you're manufacturing, and it's suddenly almost a different entity. Did you at that point have to immediately think about building the team, or was it a case of let's try and raise some money first and know what we can get before we build the team?
So I think from memory, we went from 20 people to 40 people within about 12 months after funding. So it was sort of a very, very rapid expansion of the business. And the funding is the essential element to be able to do that. You know, we couldn't have done that bootstrapped the way we were at the time. So it needed that infusion of capital in order to fund the business and also the facilities to support it, because it's all very well to say, well, we're going to hire 20 more people, including people that understand how to, start scaling a manufacturing process. But if you don't have the right infrastructure and equipment on which to actually start doing pilot manufacturing, then that doesn't make any sense. So one of the challenges of hardware deep tech businesses compared to sort of software and AI and so forth is that capital early on is actually a really critical requirement to have the physical facilities you need to develop the process or the product.
Mm. Building a team is crucial to most businesses. So what sort of qualities do you look for in the people you brought on board early on, and especially in the early stages? And that could be for any of the companies.
Yeah, so in the early stages, well, I guess firstly I would say one thing I always look for now as I'm building a team is how does the jigsaw fit together? So I think, again, there's the sort of theoretical view that I might have learnt, in 30 years ago was, what kind of structural hierarchies can you build a business around? What roles do you need? Things like that. My approach tends to be much more around thinking about, well, what is the mix of skill sets and experience and perspectives you need in the business? And how do you make sure between the entire team, you cover all of those bases? So it's not a sort of fixed model of, I need a CTO and a COO and a CFO and, these people underneath them. That's obviously sort of part of it, but actually the specific roles can be fairly fluid. It's about getting that right combination of things into the business. And so when you hire one person, depending on exactly what their particular skill set and experience is, it may change what you're looking for in the next role you're hiring. So that was sort of, I guess, a sort of starting principle. But then in terms of the underlying qualities that we look for beyond the particular skills or experience we need is often, attitude is absolutely critical. Attitude, I'd say, trumps experience at all times, particularly in early stage business. You want people who are just going to get stuck in and do stuff. If you hire someone for a particular role, the chances are your business strategy is going to change slightly, and what you need from that person is a little bit different from what you hired them for. So if you're just hiring someone who's got very specific expertise in one role and that's all they want to do, there's a good chance that's not going to fit a year down the line. So having people that have perhaps a little bit more of a jack of all trades type approach, or at least a mindset where they're happy to sort of jump in and fill gaps and be comfortable with a role that is changing over time and might need something different, 6 months later, that I think is a really important factor. We also focus very heavily at Pragmatic on company culture. Again, it's sort of probably the first time at a startup where I've actually with the team properly formalized the culture in terms of, what values are we expecting and things like that. And we certainly didn't do that day one. It wasn't sort of something that started with the business, but it was sort of somewhere into that early scaling journey where we realized that if we didn't do that, we were going to lose control of the culture and how we wanted it to be. And so we focused on, let's think hard about, why was it we really liked working with these first 20 people? And, what is it that might not be easily sustainable as we scale and how do we focus on those bits. So I think those underlying elements are important. And then the final thing for me is comfort with a venture journey. So the nature of a venture funded business is it's unpredictable. You know, your strategy might change regularly. You might go out of business at any given point because you run out of money or realize that what you're trying to do doesn't actually make sense or things like that. So actually, that's really important that people who join the business, particularly if they join from a large organization, that they understand that difference. They're comfortable with those risks. It fits with their personal situation and lifestyle and family commitments and all those kinds of things. So for about, at least until about we were at 80 to 100 people, I interviewed everybody, even if it was a role that I had no value to add in the interview process in terms of the expertise, I would at least have a sort of 15, 20 minute sit down with them as the final stage of a process and say, you know, this is the type of company we're trying to build. You know, here's what will be exciting. Here's what will be challenging. Here's where the risks are. You know, is this something that really fits with you? And I think that to me was an important thing to feel comfortable bringing people on that weren't kind of coming into something blind and being surprised by things that were going to financially inconvenience them or, you know, cause family problems or whatever.
That's really interesting and probably excellent advice for lots of founders. Twofold. One, that kind of company culture early as possible. But again, I guess you having gone through that process a number of times with other startups, it's something that you would have gradually found out how important it is early on to build that. I'm also thinking with your sort of approach to leadership, I guess having scaled multiple businesses, how's that approach to leadership changed from when you were starting out?
So probably two things I'd say have changed significantly. One is a better understanding of the difference between leadership and management. So, you know, very simplistically, you know, management is obviously sort of keeping control of everything and directing who does what, whereas leadership is more about sort of setting vision and aspiration and context and an environment and, you know, and then letting people sort of flourish within that. And they're not mutually exclusive, but it's actually quite difficult for one person to do both simultaneously. And I think what I've kind of realized over time is that actually what you typically need in a business as it scales is leadership rather than management. You actually need to be able to delegate management to more people because you can't manage it all yourself. So increasingly your role evolves to being leading, providing the right environment, you know, and inspiring people to hopefully then do well and ensuring that within the team you have a good layer of management who can keep control of the details. So I think that's one thing that's changed. The second thing I think is somewhat related to that delegation is being able to leverage other people's strengths and recognizing that just because you're CEO of a business doesn't mean you have to be the best at everything. In fact, you're never going to be the best at everything. What you want is to make sure you've got other people in the team around you who are much better at the things that you're not so good at and, you know, give them the authority and responsibility and ownership to do that. And, you know, I mean, coming back to the team building point as a good example, I would say people management and team building is not one of my strengths. It's an essential requirement in a startup, but it's something that I'm not inherently particularly good at. I've got a little better at it over the years because you have to, but it's still something that I rely a lot on having other people in my team. You know, Richard Price, my co-founder and CTO, beyond his technical capabilities, one of the reasons the partnership between us works so well was he is really, really good just at that team dynamic aspect of things. So I relied a lot on him as we were building the team to kind of keep us on track in how we were management team, how we were motivating them, how our culture was evolving. You know, he took ownership of a lot of those things because he was fundamentally a lot better at doing that stuff than I was.
You're a serial entrepreneur and you've helped build a number of companies, obviously. How did you manage to sort of juggle that early on? Did any of them overlap and become too much? I'm trying to get a sense of what it's like to to be a serial entrepreneur and how you managed to managed to survive.
Well, I think the first, the first five were all serial. They were one after the other, and the transition point was a was an exit of some kind. You know, it was when the business was sold, and by definition, if you're CEO or senior management in a company like that, there's a good chance that staying with the acquired business does not make sense, at least past a certain transition period. So, so in that sense, the sort of decision to move on to something else wasn't even a decision that needed to be made. It was just, well, this is the logical exit for the business, and therefore I go on and do something else. Now, in that journey, actually, when I was starting Pragmatic, I also had two other non-exec roles early on in that journey. Those I picked up when kind of we were just getting going, and it was still, in a sense, Pragmatic was sort of a part-time thing because we didn't have enough of a team for it to take up, all of my time. And then as Pragmatic got more and more, scaled and more significant, actually managing those alongside it became more challenging. So ultimately, those two companies both got sold, which sort of solved that problem as well. But I'd say, trying to do more than one in parallel when you're in an executive full-time role, I would generally try and avoid. Now, of course, in the last 12 months or so, I've shifted to a non-exec portfolio role where, I'm now working with four companies from a non-exec perspective. That's a very, very different beast. By definition, as a non-exec, you shouldn't be getting too involved in the day-to-day stuff. So you have a bit more time. And actually there, I think having perspectives across multiple businesses, contacts that you kind of leverage in common across different businesses actually is part of the value add. You can add more value by taking, learnings that you suddenly come across in one company into another company. And, and there it's more about sort of statistical management of the bandwidth is how I think of it. So, I can't afford to commit 100% of my time because I know that, on average, they might need each company might need a certain amount of time, but there's going to be huge peaks and troughs within that. There's going to be certain times where companies need a lot more support from their boards, fundraising being probably the most obvious one, but there's other sort of strategic initiatives that tend to take a lot of time. So I've sort of been very carefully thinking about how do I allocate my time to ensure that I can manage sort of at least a couple of simultaneous peaks in different businesses at the same time.
Mm. And in those non-exec roles, do you find that really rewarding? You said it's a very different beast altogether, but what do you get out of those sorts of roles?
Yeah, it is very rewarding. I mean, there's obviously there's one bit that is less enjoyable in a sense, which is you don't have complete ownership. And in fact, it's important not to take ownership. The founding management and CEO have to feel like, they're in control of the business and they're driving the decisions. And that's something of sort of having been in their shoes, I can be very, very strong on and help make sure the rest of the board aren't stepping on management's toes. And so I think, that's sort of one of the things I enjoy is how do I help the management team get the best dynamic and the best value out of their board? And also how do I just sort of provide a sounding board of ideas? How do I leverage all the experience I've got, to help these other journeys? And when I've been picking the companies to get involved in, partially it's about a technology sector that I'm excited about and a business plan that I think is going to be successful. But as much I'm looking at the challenges the business might have and if they're things that, I think I can really actually add something to.
Yeah, I'm sure, again, all that sort of experience of the challenges, the failures, the setbacks are probably as useful as anything. In fact, on that, not to dwell on too much negative, but you must have had lots of failures and setbacks in your whole journey. What's your mindset when something has just not worked out as planned or feels like it's something that's almost insurmountable?
So one of my colleagues had a great perspective on this. I can't remember his exact wording, but the principle was everything that is difficult to solve is adding value when you finally solve it. So all of these, every challenge you have, every setback, everything that goes wrong, every decision you make that turned out to be a wrong one that you then got to reverse and make it better, actually increases your competitive differentiation over time. It's something that makes it harder for somebody else trying to do the same journey. They're going to fall into exactly the same pitfalls. And so, you know, I think that's one really interesting way of looking at it a lot of the time is that most of the things that go wrong are things that go wrong, not because you've fundamentally made a mistake or done things the wrong way, but because you were dealing with unknowns. You're trying to do something that's never been done before. And therefore, you know, statistics say there's a lot of times, you know, you're going to get it wrong the first way you try and solve it, or you're, you know, you're not even going to have known that that problem existed until suddenly it tripped you up. And so I think that that kind of glass half full perspective of, well, having gone through the pain of, you know, it going wrong and you figuring out how to fix it, actually what you end up with is something that is an even more defensible position, because there's another set of things you've solved that anybody else trying to do the same thing would have to tackle as well. And if you could do that and generate protectable IP or key know-how, or, you know, things that yeah, allow you to protect that part of the journey, then it's actually really positive, because it's another barrier for someone else to ever go and compete with you.
That's a really interesting way to look at it. So looking back, if you could go back in time and I guess and give yourself some, you're a younger version of yourself, one piece of advice about entrepreneurship, what would it be? there might be a few.
Yeah, I don't know that there's one piece of advice. I mean, I think probably the interesting bit that I wouldn't have realized and that has shifted a lot in time is sort of being prepared for the length of the journey. So I think there's often a perception that companies that are successful, that it all kind of happens overnight. And, you know, you have this magical idea, you go do some great stuff, and then you've got a $1 billion company. And, you know, there are probably a few cases where that has happened, but in the vast majority of cases, the journey is nowhere near that simple, and it takes a long time. There's a comment I heard from a very, very successful, it's under Chatham House rules, so I can't mention who it is, but it'd be a very well-known entrepreneur. And his comment was something like, overnight success takes at least 10 years. And, you know, I think that is something that is generally not recognized when you're at the start of an entrepreneurial journey, because you just hear about all these big success stories and you think, okay, well, in a couple of years' time, I'm going to be wildly successful. And that generally is not how it plays out. And I think particularly with deep tech, as compared to conventional tech companies, you know, a conventional tech company, which I would characterize as not inventing new science, but just leveraging technology in a clever way for a new product, that can actually be really quick, you know, because you can get a product to market within 12 months and, you know, and if it's successful, it can take off. And within a few years, you can be generating huge amounts of revenue. If you're doing deep tech, where your fundamental innovation is a new technology platform that you're solving some fundamental scientific problems to show it works, you know, that's probably 5 years before you even bottom out the technology problems, let alone get to trying to bring a product to market and proving it successful. And by definition, you're probably trying to address a market that doesn't exist yet. So you've got a whole journey around, you know, creating a new market to leverage this great new technology platform that never existed before. So, you know, that's a long journey. It's a really exciting journey, but only if you kind of understand how long it's going to be. And therefore, I think, you know, the biggest advice is you have to be enjoying the journey, not just the possible end goal. If you're focused only on the end goal as your motivation for what you're doing, at some point the journey is going to get too hard, probably. Whereas if you're actually enjoying the journey as you go through it, because you're working with a great team of people and solving really challenging problems, and that's kind of what excites you and makes you want to get out of bed in the morning, then that's a sustainable model that can go for the 10 years you need to make it an overnight success.
Good. Yeah. Again, great advice. And in terms of like entrepreneurial communities, like I guess like Ideaspace, they're often invaluable to founders. How important do you think sort of networking and finding those support systems are? You know, how important are they for you?
Yeah, I think that is really important. The big decisions, if you like, you have to figure out yourself as you go through the journey. But there's an awful lot of smaller things that just become distractions or frustrations or things that suck time away from being able to think about the really important things. And that's where I think these communities and the other sort of support infrastructures you have in the ecosystem are really important. So, yeah, I mean, at Pragmatic, we started in Ideaspace and, you know, everything from just the physical infrastructure and the ease of sort of having a desk you could go in and sit at that had, you know, reliable internet access and a printer and things like that, to, you know, the lunchtime conversations with other people who are going through things. Those are important. You know, more recently, I think one of the most exciting developments we've had in the UK is the Bessemer Society, which is a network of hard tech entrepreneurs. And, you know, that's really important because actually, you know, hardware tech has its own set of challenges, which are quite different from software or fintech or AI or things like that. And, you know, being able to chat with other people who might have quite different businesses, but if you're making a physical hardware product, actually there's a lot of similarities in terms of capital intensivity and how that drives funding strategy and how you think about growing the business and so forth. So those, yeah, I think those kind of networks are really valuable, both from an emotional perspective of just having peers you can chat to and gripe and, you know, share war stories and realize that, you know, it's not just you that's having a hard time at things, as well as, you know, often just finding, you know, practical solutions for the simple things. Oh, I'm trying to do this. Have you ever come across this? Who do I go talk to? You know, if I want, you know, a lawyer that knows about X, or, you know, which accounting firm should I pick? Have you worked with any of these two before?
Yeah.
Those sort of just the more boring stuff, if you like, but that, you know, still requires time and effort, and often you can, you know, you can leverage other people's experience.
Yeah, yeah. And I guess also just seeing that other people are struggling as well. So you just exactly. Don't think it's not just yourself. So this podcast is going to be going out during Cambridge Tech Week. And we know, obviously, you're deeply involved in the tech space. How do you see Cambridge and the wider UK tech ecosystem evolving? And what makes it such a unique place for startups to grow and to thrive?
So I'm slightly conflicted here. So on the one hand, if you look at tech ecosystems, having a certain amount of critical mass in certain areas is actually really valuable. So, you know, the Cambridge tech ecosystem, the more we can grow that, the more successful it can be. Having said that, when I look at it from an international perspective, you know, if you take Cambridge or Oxford or London by themselves, they are small compared to Silicon Valley, say, or even Boston or, you know, the sort of, you know, Texas, Dallas-Fort Worth area and things like that. So when I think about this from the perspective of how do we make the UK as successful as possible, then I think we need to strike a really careful balance between encouraging regional or city-based clusters, because they certainly do have benefits, but not doing that in a way that actually creates barriers between those regions within the UK. You know, the UK ecosystem in general is going to be most successful if everybody works effectively with each other and reinforces each other, and then the UK becomes a cluster on an international basis.
Mm. Yeah, thank you. And in terms of just, I'm thinking obviously new founders that we've got that might be listening in, it's going to be really hard. It's a hard question, this. But what's the best piece of advice that you might give them when they're looking, you know, when they're trying to navigate all the ups and downs of building something from the ground up?
Focus on getting satisfaction from the journey, not the end goal.
Yeah.
The end goal may well change. It may ultimately be unattainable, you know, and, you know, even if it is, you know, a great success, actually, you know, the money is, you know, money is not the most satisfying thing in the world anyway. You know, the satisfying thing is doing things that you feel are worthwhile with people that you enjoy spending time with.
Yeah.
So, you know, that to me is the really great part about the entrepreneurial environment, is you're not a small cog in a huge machine of a big company where you don't influence anything. You know, whatever you do in a small company influences the outcome for the company. good or bad. You know, everybody, you know, when you've got a small team, everybody is in that boat, even if, you know, you might be the founder and CEO, but everybody down to, you know, the receptionist or admin actually impacts how successful the company is. And so, you know, building a team of people that just are excited by that journey, enjoy the process, and that, you know, when you go into the office every day, you you like facing these challenges, and, and you get positive energy from facing challenges rather than it being sort of a hurdle to an end goal, I think is, that's a really important mindset to adopt, I think.
Yeah, thank you. And looking to the future, what's next for you? I'd be remiss of me not to ask if there's, you know, are there any new ventures on the or projects on the horizon that you might be excited about, or have you had enough of all this?
No, so I certainly have. I've decided that probably I am not going to do another full-time executive role. I always hesitate to say never, but I don't think that makes sense, just given where my life and family environment and so forth is. But I'm really enjoying sort of doing what I'm doing at the moment. So what I decided when you know, handing over the reins at Pragmatic and starting to step back from day-to-day activity there was I wanted to focus on three things. One is a small portfolio of non-exec roles where I can help exciting companies and great entrepreneurs, you know, achieve what they want to do. Secondly, working with a couple of selected VCs sort of more across their portfolio. And that to me is exciting, just to have a broader perspective across the tech ecosystem and sort of what's happening and what exciting things are coming through. And thirdly, and I'd never, you know, a decade ago, I'd never expect to say this, but working with government, you know, it's something that we increasingly were doing at Pragmatic. It became a key part of our story and a key part of actually our success in being relevant to what not just UK government, but governments around the world are trying to achieve from a geopolitical perspective and national economic security. And so, you know, that is actually now a sort of important piece of sort of personally what, you know, what I continue to be interested in is how do we make the UK a better place for tech companies to grow and scale from a funding environment perspective. And also how do we leverage that, you know, for the best outcome given the somewhat bizarre geopolitical environment the world is evolving in at the moment.
And with this kind of this world of rapidly changing tech advancements, how do you see the role of technology in evolving and how it shapes the future of startups and entrepreneurship?
I think it's impossible to not talk about AI as part of the answer to that. But I think I would frame AI in perhaps a slightly different way to most in that context. So AI 5 or 10 years ago, I would have put in the bucket of deep tech. Now it is not. You know, if you look at 90% of what's happening in AI, it is applying it to interesting problems.
Right.
And that's going to be game changing in a lot of industries. But it's not actually fundamental new technology. It's just actually technology's got to a point now where you can do really, really exciting things with it. And so it's applying that. And personally, I really enjoyed the sort of more transformational start of that journey. So, you know, when I was looking at what sectors I wanted to get involved in from a non-exec perspective, there was three sectors I picked out and I'm really chuffed that I've managed to find exciting companies all of those. But you know, one was quantum computing, one was robotics and one was space. And, you know, the reason for picking those is I think that all that, you know, coming up to those inflection points where, you know, these are great ideas that have been around for a while, but are getting to the point where they are, yeah, a bit like, you know, in 5 or 10 years' time, they could be where AI is, where they just fundamentally change the way you think about everything you do. And so, you know, being in a, you know, you know, I wouldn't quite say the ground floor, but you know, in the stage of that journey where they become that transformational technology, I think is really exciting, and hopefully, you know, you can help make that happen and guide it in a direction that is going to create the most value and positive benefit for people around the world.
And just before we wrap up, a couple of things. Looking back on your whole career, how do you feel? It must fill you with a sense of pride, or, you know, just do you feel satisfied? It sounds like, without maybe going on to some other great venture, you probably might have felt some satisfaction. But yeah, tell me how you might feel about looking back at it. This isn't like one of those award ceremonies where it's just like, and it's time to go now.
Do I feel satisfied? So if I look at what I've done in the companies I've been involved in, you know, I would say in all of them, I'd say I could have done a much better job at things, because in hindsight, you always can see things that you should have done differently or better. So the satisfaction, again, to me, I don't think comes from kind of the end outcome, because you can always, you know, you can always use arguments to say, well, you know, that could have been a better outcome. Actually, the satisfaction to me comes from a couple of things. You know, one is the teams you build, you know, the people that make their careers in your company. I mean, you know, Pragmatic, we've got, you know, some employees who were there from the start, you know, joined within the first couple of months and are still there 15 years later, and, you know, have built essentially their entire career off the back of Pragmatic. You know, that's really exciting. You know, they've built a family in that time, you know, so we've, you know, we're now supporting, 300-400 employees and their families, and, you know, all to actually support their life while doing something that's really exciting and game-changing on a global basis. So I think that's probably one of the biggest satisfactions, is just that direct impact on people's lives, of people that you know and have known for a number of years, and they're doing something that's far more exciting and far more rewarding than they would have perhaps if Pragmatic hadn't existed. And then I think it's the end applications, I'd say, is the other end of the spectrum. So, you know, what does the technology get used for? You know, if it only makes money, but it's making money doing stuff that you don't feel is improving anybody's life, that's not really satisfying. But when you can see, you know, as I mentioned, I think one of the game-changing bits about Pragmatic was when you realized that actually we could sort of direct the technology to applications that were going to make the world a better place. And that's then become a fundamental underpinning of how we've driven the strategy since that realization. So whether it's around sustainability or national security or things like that, you know, these are the things that are satisfying, you know, that actually we can do something there that has a lasting mark on the world.
Mm. Well, it's been really interesting and inspiring in lots of ways as well, listening to you talk about the journey. And we just really appreciate you coming on the podcast. Thank you so much.
Oh, great to chat to you. I enjoyed it.
For more information or any inquiries about joining Ideaspace, please contact us via ideaspace.cam.ac.uk or via any of our social media channels.